Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Congressman Josh Riley was in the area yesterday, and our own Patricio Rubio caught up with him. The congressman for New York's 19th is pushing to lower egg prices and support family farmers. Patricio's conversation with the congressman is coming up. Now that spring is officially here, more people are thinking about that first hike of the season in the Catskills. But what should you bring with you? Radio Catskill contributor Tracy Gates talks to longtime hiker and founder of the Catskill 4000 Club, Paul Misko. Catskill 4000 Club is a hiking group that focuses on history-themed hikes and events. And it's Friday, and that means Dan Hoost is here with an update from Sullivan County Government. All coming up, but first, the news from NPR.
NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge in Maryland has blocked Elon Musk's Doge entity from accessing personal data stored at the Social Security Administration. The judge also ruled Doge must delete any personally identifiable information gathered so far. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
In her ruling, Judge Ellen Lipton Hollander wrote that Musk's team has essentially been engaged in what she called a fishing expedition at the Social Security Administration. And this expedition, she wrote, has been based on little more than suspicion of fraud. The judge also noted that the agency gave members of Musk's team, quote, unbridled access to the personal and private data of millions of Americans. That includes Social Security numbers, medical records, and bank and credit card information. And while the court has now limited Doge's access to much of that information, it does say that the agency is still allowed to hand over data that adheres to federal privacy laws. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
President Trump is moving ahead with his executive action to eliminate the Department of Education. The agency was created by Congress, and only Congress can fully get rid of it. But Trump is slashing the Education Department's staff by nearly half. He's getting strong backing from supporters, including Indiana Republican Governor Mike Braun.
I'm a believer in competition. I like choice, and I especially like parents being in the driver's seat of their own kids' education, not the federal government trying to tell us how to do that.
However, a group of 21 Democratic attorneys general is suing to stop these actions. Israel's Supreme Court has temporarily blocked the dismissal of the country's domestic intelligence chief. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had moved to fire Shin Bet's chief, Ronen Bar. Critics allege this is part of a power grab by Netanyahu. Thousands of Israelis have demonstrated against the firing. The Israeli Supreme Court's decision will block the dismissal of the Shin Bet leader until an appeal can be heard. Ukraine and Russia are accusing each other of continuing to attack energy infrastructure. This comes ahead of ceasefire talks that are supposed to take place soon in Saudi Arabia. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Ukraine says Russia also shelled civilian areas in two regions overnight.
Ukraine says Moscow's airstrikes destroyed residential neighborhoods in Zaporizhia and Odessa provinces Friday, smashing civilian homes and injuring at least six people, including a child. Zaporizhia is one of the four Ukrainian regions partially occupied by Russian forces that President Vladimir Putin annexed in a referendum 2 years ago. He says Russia must have these provinces in any peace deal, even though it doesn't fully control three of them. Ukraine says it will never cede these territories to Russia. Experts say any peace deal would likely mean freezing the front line where it is and creating a Korean Peninsula-type situation in Europe. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR. There's a significant interruption in international airline flights today. A major airline hub is closed, London's Heathrow Airport. Power was cut after a large fire broke out at a nearby substation. Hundreds of thousands of passengers are affected. Some travelers have even been diverted to other countries. More than 30,000 customers in eastern Nebraska are still out of power. Earlier this week, a powerful blizzard stormed through and snapped power lines and disrupted electricity supplies. During their first year of college, students often experience a decline in their mental health. From Northwest Public Broadcasting, Lauren Patterson explains how new research shows spending time with therapy dogs might help.
Rather than petting a dog right before a test, students at Washington State University spent time with therapy dogs for longer sessions over their first semester. New research showed students who spent time with therapy dogs were less stressed and depressed than students who didn't. Patricia Pendry is a WSU professor who worked on the study.
We find that giving them the opportunity to engage with registered therapy animals is actually a wonderful way to help them adjust to that first semester.
Students who met and spent time with dogs over their first semester also had marked improvements in self-compassion, she says. It's also a relatively inexpensive way to offer students who might be missing their pets from home more support, Pendry says. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Patterson in Pullman, Washington.
Stocks are significantly lower on Wall Street. The Dow was down 450 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We'll get to Patricio Rubio's conversation with Congressman Josh Riley in just a little bit. But first, let's check in with Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government and joins us every Friday. Hello.
Hello.
You're the top billing here.
Well, as the weather would tell you, I blew right in here, I'm ready to put some hot air out there. So,
well, let's get started with your hot air and your Dan jokes.
We're
warming up to those.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about the legislative meeting yesterday in Monticello. The legislature met as scheduled. A few resolutions and proclamations, and also a tourism enhancement grant program, which was amended so that we can have some more information about what's going on with some grants for our tourism industry. What's going on there?
Yeah, the legislature has been talking about actually for a few years. Originally, it was going to be something completely in-house where separate from the Visitors Association, which we're contracted with to do the tourism promotion, the county was going to give funds directly to nonprofits interested in mounting large-scale single or multi-day events to attract people to the county, preferably things that were new, but also things that were existing. So over the months and years, that has morphed into that. That's still the original goal, but morphed into now it being funneled through the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association. This is over $1 million worth of increased room tax that we've had, and the SCVA gets most of it anyway. They get 85%. They're getting also an additional $1 million that they've been sending out through grants, and this now will be a new program for them, the Tourism Enhancement Grants Program. There was some talk at legislature about should it be a reimbursable grant? Should we be giving money ahead of time? There was some disagreement for a little bit on the legislature about that, but eventually they decided we don't want to force people to come up with more than, I think there's a minimum 35% match beyond that, so that we really want to see this get going. There were concerns from audit to saying, well, you're giving out money before you really have receipts for what's been paid for, and it's a valid argument on both sides. So it was interesting to watch. If you want to watch it, it's available at sullivanny.gov. But the short and the long of it, I think I've done the long of it now, is that this program, there'll be application form going out very, very soon. It'll be open to nonprofits that are looking to bring large-scale events. Nothing necessarily that has to be hugely expensive, but something that will have a demonstrable impact on tourism in Sullivan County, even if it's just for that day. There's going to be a review committee that includes Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association folks and four legislators, legislator Matt McPhillips, legislator Amanda Ward, legislator Terry Blosser Bernardo, and legislator Kat Scott. And the grants will be not reimbursable, but there will be skin in the game that is required. And I'll be posting shortly the rules and regulations on that.
Can you talk a little bit about the criteria when you say large scale? What are you talking about here in terms of that criteria?
Well, eligible projects, there we go, should create a new facility or experience or expand and increase the impact of existing attractions. The funded activity must be a new and discrete project or an enhancement of an existing event with a schedule and demonstrated outcome. These may include new or expanded special events, festivals and community celebrations, marketing and advertising campaigns and promotional activities. So it doesn't have to be actually an event. Equipment and capital expenses only associated with a special event, festival or celebration for which funding is requested. It can't be just a capital project that you have going on that you think one day will enhance tourism. It has to be tied to something specific.
What is the range of grants that are available? How much is available?
Let me see here real quickly. You're catching me. You're still getting to understand exactly how it works here because it just got passed yesterday with further amendments. But let me just see here. I believe it will start at around $5,000 and go up, I think. Or no, excuse me. The minimum award for this grant program is $25,000.
Minimum.
Grant award. And I think it could end up going much higher than that.
So you're really looking for large-scale projects.
They really are.
For events, concerts, festivals, that kind of stuff, right?
Yep.
All right. That's good information to know. You say you're putting out some more information about that later for folks who might be interested in
that. Yes, this is something now that we're – this is the first place I've talked about it. You're getting the exclusive here at WJFF.
Breaking news with Dan.
That's why I wasn't fully like, okay, let me find the answer to that. But we'll have that out shortly, and hopefully I will become a little bit of a better expert on it here shortly.
We'll get all the information for you. Let's talk about this resolution that was passed about local electric utility rate hikes. That has been in the news recently, of course, with folks getting those staggering electric bills across the state, really.
Yes.
What is the legislature doing about it with this resolution?
Well, the legislature had introduced a resolution yesterday specifically about NYSEG, proposing significant rate increases for electric and gas. This is not about the rate increases that have already happened. As NYSEG and others have said, that's tied to delivery charges that they feel they don't have any control over. But of course, people are suffering left and right, and that's why this resolution also got expanded to Orange and Rockland Utilities and Central Hudson. Mm-hmm. Those are the three power companies that serve various parts of Sullivan County. NYSEG is the largest by far presence in Sullivan County, but Central Hudson's up around Grahamsville and Orange and Rockland is down around Glen Spey, that area. So, I believe O&R just announced that they got their rate increases already, so I'm not so much sure what impact this resolution will have on that, but they're hoping at least with NYSEG and Central Hudson that the Public Service Commission takes a real hard look, a critical look at what they're asking for. The legislature in the end, though, even says that they oppose NYSEG's, O&R and Central Hudson's rate increases. Basically to say, because locals can't take anymore. This is already, people have seen their bills double and triple. And again, I'm sure the utility companies probably would say, well, that wasn't charges that come back to us, and we still need to maintain infrastructure and do what we need to do to properly serve the public. But there is a pain point that has been reached. This legislature is very aware and sensitive to that and is saying, we can't take any more hikes.
And for those folks who are experiencing this pain point, this pain of these high bills, what does this resolution do? How does that help them?
Well, the resolution it adds a voice, a significant and influential voice, probably to a number of other counties, too, that are talking to the Public Service Commission and saying, you can't do this. You just can't allow this at this point. Whether the Public Service Commission in the end follows through on that, listens to that, or says, no, we're going to do it anyway, or there's a compromise reached, I don't have that crystal ball. If I did, I would be a very wealthy person.
You wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I could pay everyone's electric bills. But I am here. So hopefully it makes an impact because the legislature was unanimous on this, except for Matt McPhillips had to abstain because he's NYSEG's local community representative. So it was an 8-0 vote. He wasn't opposed to it or anything. He had to recuse himself from it. But it passed otherwise unanimously. So legislators have heard the cries of the public and said, we've got to figure something else out here.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government, and he joins us every Friday with an update on the legislature and some news from there, including another resolution that passed unanimously. This is concerning the acquisition of the former Caroland property in the town of Neversink. Let's remind folks about that property and what the proposals are here, what the resolution does.
Yeah, this property has a little bit of an interesting history. It's about 3,100 acres off Pole Road up in the town of Neversink. I think at one point the property might have also crossed over into the town of Rockland, near the hamlet of Willowemock. If you've never been up there, it's a beautiful ride. It's an alternative to get up to Frost Valley and Slide Mountain, rather than going through Claryville, although that's a beautiful ride too. Anyway, all that said is, back in the late 60s, a developer had purchased that acreage and planned what was going to be the Catskills' largest ski hill. It would have been a competitor with places like Bel Air and Hunter and Wyndham. And it never actually came to fruition because the town of Neversink was a dry town at that time, meaning that it didn't permit alcohol sales. And the developer felt that that was a non-negotiable item. He had to have alcohol sales. Well, didn't happen, and the property was not developed. However, it stayed in that family's same hands for decades. And a few years ago, the descendants wanted to do some sort of conservation residential development there. But ultimately, the town of Neversink board felt that that didn't fit in with their comprehensive plan. So the property, I didn't realize this, went up for sale, and the Open Space Institute purchased it with the intent to transfer it to New York State. I don't know that it'll technically become part of the Catskill Park, but it's within the Catskill Park boundaries, and the idea between the Open Space Institute and the state is to preserve it for recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. It does have, if you ever look at an aerial image or satellite image, you can still see all the ski hills were the trees were removed, so you could see what the ski hill would have looked like, there was nothing ever built other than maybe a hunting cabin or something up there. So now the state is about to acquire it, except that they don't accept title insurance, meaning that there could be as much as a 2 to 5 year process, I've been told, to search the title out, going all the way back 200 years, the title history of the property. And that would just delay things in the town and Open Space Institute's minds needlessly. Mm-hmm. And the legislature agrees with them on that. So they put this resolution together to urge the state to expedite the process legally. Don't bypass any legal things, but there should be a way that you can do this much faster than in 2 to 5 years. They're hoping maybe as quick as this year to open it up, to have hiking trails, cross-country skiing trails, and to actually make it a beautiful recreational area.
Also, a resolution passed, or a proclamation made, I guess, is how it's technically termed, mm-hmm. for Women's History Month.
Yes. Yeah, Kat Scott, our District 5 legislator, had created a proclamation recognizing this month as Women's History Month. It was also something that she really wanted to put forward to show the impact of women locally, including her fellow female legislators, because we have 4 of them. We have Kat, we have legislator, District 9 legislator Terry Blosser Bernardo, District 8 legislator Amanda Ward, a District 2 legislator, who is the chair, mm-hmm. Nadia Reich. Mm-hmm. And each of them have been trailblazers in their own right. Terry was former chair of the Ulster County Legislature. Amanda is our first African-American female legislator. And Nadia, she's not the first female chair of the legislature. I think she might have been, though, the first female supervisor of the town of Lumberland. So I took a picture of them with the proclamation. Going to put that up on social media today, just giving kudos to the strong women in Sullivan County. If my mom's listening, I was raised by one, very appreciative of everything that they've done for, what shall I say, the other half of the species for which I apologize for.
your mom, you're making your mom proud. One other little bit of business here, too, is that a longtime Deputy Republican Election Commissioner Pam Murren, mm-hmm. is that saying that correctly, mm-hmm. is succeeding Commissioner Lori Benjamin. What is that role there?
Well, Lori decided it was time to retire. Her husband has also retired, and they're looking to travel the world, or at least the country, in an RV, I think is what she told me. So she was only at the beginning of her four-year term, which she was elected into that by the committee, the Republican committee people, because she's the Republican elections commissioner. There's also a Democratic elections commissioner, Deanna. She's staying. And so when she announced she would retire, the Republicans said, well, what do you think? Let's put your deputy in, Pam, who has been with the Board of Elections for 21 years. I found that out this morning. And so everyone agreed to it. The legislature had to do a formal resolution of it just to say, yes, of course. And she will start that at the end of April and serve out the remaining. Pam will serve out the remainder of Lori's term through 2028, at which point then if she decides to continue, she will be running for election and only with the Republican committee. This is not for the general public to vote on. But congratulations to Pam. And I would say I'm looking forward to working with her, but I have been already, so I'm just looking forward to continuing to work with her.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, updates on the tax foreclosed property redemption, a blood drive, and a rabies clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government. We'll be right back. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York. An experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year. NACL.org.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound Supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound Supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound Supporter. Go to WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're back with Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. There is a blood drive today at the Government Center we should let folks know about. It's underway now.
Yes, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. So what are we at right now? At 10:30, you still have several hours that you can go. Walk-ins are welcome. It will be in the hearing room of the Government Center on the second floor. It is accessible via an elevator, easy to get in and out of at 100 North Street in Monticello. There is always a desperate need for blood. Please, if you can donate, come on by.
And then we mentioned before the break about the tax foreclosed property redemption. What is that? That is, if you owe taxes, you can still pay up to a certain date without penalty?
Right, right. If your property is in danger of being foreclosed upon because lack of payment of taxes, the county is interested in working with you as much as it is legally able to do so. So one of the first steps that they do, of course, is send you a delinquency notice, and you can try to resolve it then and there, but some people can't. So they have till April 30th of this year, if they are in danger of it being put on the tax auction later this year, to make payment. It has to be made directly to the treasurer's office. Either you have to mail it in or you have to come in person. It's not something that a payment can be made online about. But as County Treasurer Nancy Buck says, we want everyone to remain in their homes and keep their properties for as long as they are able. The very last resort is foreclosure. It's not something that we get some gleeful joy out of doing. So, and even after the that April 30th deadline passes, there'll be a repurchase option available. Details will be forwarded directly to the owners at the last known address, though. So that's not something I'll be putting out.
The Council of Government, what is that? There was a meeting about that to discuss a lot of things, it looks like.
Yeah.
But what is the Council of Government? Council.
Yeah, it's actually something that was created with the county charter, put into the county charter about 15 years ago, a little bit, actually more like 20, where there was a feeling that there still needed to be more involvement of town supervisors, village mayors, school boards, and other leaders of the community in the proceedings of the legislature. So the charter actually mandates, I believe, an annual meeting of Council of Government. I keep wanting to say governments because technically that's what it is, but I didn't come up with the wording. And so Chair Nadia Reich did the first one of her term, finally happened yesterday. There's an audio recording I'll be posting about that. They discussed a range of issues because we had school superintendents, town supervisors, village mayors there. We had SUNY Sullivan's president, BOCES, superintendent. And they talked about, for example, the Sullivan Promise Scholarship and what some of the other schools are doing to build upon that. They talked about short-term rental sales tax collection, because right now there's short-term rental room tax collection, but also now there's coming along sales tax collection. Of course, the perennial issue, and it's always a controversial one, and it was again yesterday, was sharing sales tax revenue with the towns and villages. Other counties do it. We don't. The towns think we should. Legislators, I think the majority, say, no, that would not be responsible. There are major expenses coming up that we need to make sure that we are preparing for appropriately. Also, there's a countywide EMS district that is being talked about as well. So these were all topics that were discussed. There have been Council of Government meetings in the past, but I don't know that they've happened as frequently as the charter has required in the past. I think there's an intent to do so maybe even more frequently than the charter requires, but I don't know. We'll find that out as we move forward.
And it's a way for input to the legislature from various stakeholders, as you mentioned, the town leaders, village folks, school folks involved with just you know, expressing their input on these various issues the legislature is considering.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A few reminders here. There's a rabies clinic coming up in Glen Spey.
Yes, April 23rd in the town of Lumberland. It's 1052 Proctor Road in Glen Spey. That's the town of Lumberland's pavilion. It is open to anyone in Sullivan County as long as you're a resident of Sullivan County. You'll need to bring photo ID as proof of your residency, but it's not just folks in like town of Lumberland, town of Highland, town of Forestburg, that area. So it is for dogs, it's for cats, and also ferrets, which I always thought it would be cool to have one.
Although the ferret slipped in there.
Yeah, it did. So all pets must be at least 3 months old, in a carrier, on a leash. Aggressive dogs need to be muzzled. Bring proof of prior rabies vaccination to receive a 3-year vaccination. But if you don't have proof, you'll still get a vaccination. It'll only be good for a year. So that, again, is going to be Wednesday, April 23rd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in the town of Lumberland Pavilion in Glen Spey.
Is there a cost?
No, it's free. Thank you for reminding me about that. It is absolutely free.
And it is important to have your animals.
We have rabies in the area. We have it every year. If you have animals that are outdoors, this is an absolute must.
And again, a reminder, the burn ban in New York State is in effect through May 15th. We saw multiple wildfires popping up even before the burn ban went into effect. And with these winds whipping around, we see it's important to remind folks about that.
Yeah, I saw our Bureau of Fire, our fire coordinator, John Hauschild, on Wednesday, and he said at that very moment there were 3 different brush fires throughout the county that they were battling, all of which they believed had been started by people burning outdoors. Don't do it, folks. It is too dry and thus way too dangerous to be doing this. And like I've said before, you could be held legally liable if a fire you started damages people's property, injures folks, or even worse.
Yeah, burn ban in New York State in effect through May 15th. And before we go, new citizens sworn in this week.
Yes, that was always, it's always a wonderful thing to go to. They have it usually every other month. The county clerk's office hosts it, usually in the county courthouse, as it was. I always live stream the taking of the oath, which I think is 25,000 people or more have seen it now online. It's just, we're at that sort of moment in our history and our culture that this has become, I don't know, even more an important event than it ever has before. Certainly for the folks that are involved, it always is. This was the first time I actually knew somebody personally who became a dual British American citizen. But there were people from all over the world, 12 of them, that became citizens. And this was a long, arduous, I think costly process too. But they got their legal certificate of citizenship And then we just took pictures and everybody celebrated. It was just a warm, joyful kind of thing that I think everyone can look at and say, bravo.
That's very good. Let's remind folks where they can see that, where they can also get all the information we talked about today at Sullivan County Government.
Sure. Our website, sullivanny.gov. We also have a YouTube channel and a Facebook page where we post these kinds of videos. You will see this video since it was live streamed. It's still available there at facebook.com/SullivanCountyGov. If you are not a fan or friend of us already on there, please become one, because I put a lot of important information out through our social media channels.
Are you on the TikTok?
Not yet. We've been thinking about it.
Maybe you could do the hoost, like like a dance.
Oh boy,
the hoost.
All right. Maybe you'll have to demonstrate on your TikTok first. Okay.
I keep saying Patricio's on the other side of the window here, smiling, and I keep saying no TikTok for me. Thanks so much. Dan Hoost is the communications director for Sullivan County Government. Joins us every Friday. Thank you so much, sir, and have a great weekend.
My pleasure. You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Patricio, speaking of, spoke to Congressman Josh Riley when he was in the area yesterday. We'll have that after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Caitlin Collins, the chief White House correspondent for CNN.
My dad will see things on Facebook about me and then call me to ask if it's true sometimes. It just shows you that people can choose their own narratives.
Caitlin Collins joins us next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Congressman Josh Riley, who represents New York's 19th district, visited Sullivan County yesterday to meet with local officials, community organizations, and rural hospitals. During his visit, he spoke with Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio about two new bipartisan bills aimed at lowering grocery costs and providing relief for family farmers across upstate New York. They're the Lowering Egg Prices Act and the Healthy Poultry Assistance and Indemnification Act, both of which seek to address key challenges faced by farmers and consumers alike. Here's Patricio with Congressman Riley.
Let's talk about the Lowering the Egg Prices Act. It's a bipartisan effort to reverse the outdated FDA regulations that are forcing farmers to throw away hundreds of millions of eggs each year. And the goal is to put more eggs on the market and bring prices down for consumers. Can you walk us through the core issue that the Lowering Egg Prices Act is addressing?
Yeah, sure. That's a pretty good summary. It's conversations I'm having with folks all across our district. Folks are always telling me the cost of living is just, it's too high. The other day I was in East Durham for the St. Patrick's Day parade and was talking to a guy who's told me he's a single dad. He's raising his daughter and he's dealing with the utility prices are getting jacked up. The housing prices are too high. Grocery bill is too high. Insurance prices are too high. And I'm working really hard to make life a little bit easier for families like that. And my bill would overturn a regulation that was put on the books back in 2009. And the impact of this regulation is that it's basically just requiring a bunch of farmers to throw away perfectly good eggs, like 400 million perfectly good eggs every year getting thrown away. And that makes no sense when we're in the middle of avian flu and we're in the middle of soaring egg prices. And so, you know, I've got two little kids at home, 4.5-year-old, a 1.5-year-old. When I tell them, don't waste your food, they understand that. But apparently Washington bureaucrats don't. And so my bill, which I worked on across the aisle with conservative Republicans, progressive Democrats, everybody in between, it's common sense, it's bipartisan, and it's gonna lower prices for folks.
Yeah. Why was this bill still on the books despite, you know, its impact on farmers and consumers?
It's a good question. It's a regulation and with the Food and Drug Administration. It's been on the books since 2009. And I think it's just like a lot of things in politics, whether it's Albany or Washington, people are out of touch and slow to fix things. And so we're going to give them a kick in the tail and get them to take this regulation off the books and put those eggs back on the market.
Yeah. Now, what kind of feedback have you received from farmers in the upstate and beyond, the sort of the challenges they face because of the rule?
Yeah, you know, with that rule in particular, it's hugely wasteful for farmers to have to throw away all of these eggs. They would love to have, these are eggs that, if you crack them, break them, and pasteurize them, they can be used in things like salad dressings and cake mix, that sort of stuff. So they're different from the eggs that you're buying in the cartons on the shelf at the grocery store. And these farmers have to throw away all these eggs. And then what happens is there's not enough of the eggs to break for those kinds of foods. So then you have to go in and get the eggs that you're buying off the shelves in the grocery store and use those. And it doesn't make any sense. We have all these perfectly good eggs. We should put them on the market, and that's going to bring down prices.
Yeah. And talk about bringing down prices. How quickly do you think we could see egg prices drop if this bill passes?
I think it would have a pretty quick impact. We're talking about 400 million eggs a year getting onto the market. And I think that could have a pretty direct and immediate impact would be my hope. And look, it's not going to solve all the problems. It's not a silver bullet, but we should be doing everything we possibly can. Every dollar that we can put back into the pockets of working families, we should be doing everything we can to do that.
Yeah, and you mentioned the avian flu. Let's talk about another bill that you supported, a bipartisan bill to support family farmers affected by the avian flu outbreaks by expanding the USDA financial assistance to those impacted, even if their farms haven't had confirmed cases but are still under these restrictive control measures. Can you tell us about the Healthy Poultry Assistance and Indemnification Act?
Yeah, and I appreciate you mentioning that both this bill and my lowering egg prices bill are bipartisan. I've been in Congress for less than 3 months. I've already sponsored or introduced close to 40 bills. Almost all of those I'm working with friends across the political spectrum, because where I come from and where most people approach politics in upstate New York, it doesn't really matter what your political party is. What matters is whether the idea is a good idea, if it's a common sense idea, and it's going to make folks' lives better. And so that's been my approach. And on this particular bill, working across the aisle to help upstate farmers deal with the bird flu. Under the current laws, if bird flu is detected in a community, as has been the case in Ulster County, Delaware County, the farms where the bird flu is detected have to take a whole bunch of measures to contain the spread of it. And those farms are usually compensated for that, because you might have to cull your flock, or you might have to take other things that do other things that could cost you a bunch of money. The problem is that usually there's a control area set up around where the virus is detected, and the farms in the control area, they've also got to take precautions usually, but they don't get compensated for that. And our farmers, particularly our smaller farmers who are already hanging on by a thread, they have to shoulder the burden of dealing with the bird flu. And that is just, that's just not fair at all. It's not smart from a public health standpoint, because we got to contain the thing. But it's also not fair to those farmers that they've got to do that. So my bill would fix that. It would support those small farmers who have to deal with bird flu. And it's bipartisan, and I'm hoping we can get it done.
Yeah. What are the next steps for this bill?
Well, thanks for that question. Next steps, we're working on a farm bill in Congress. I'm hoping that there might be an opportunity to add it there. But really, time is of the essence here, because once the wild birds migrate back north, as the weather's getting warmer, that's when we have some real risks of bird flu continuing to spread. And so I'm working with my friends on the other side of the aisle to see if we can find some ways to move this pretty quickly. The other thing that I'm doing on it is just last week, 2 weeks ago, I sat down with a bunch of scientists, veterinarians, economists from the United States Department of Agriculture, and had a really good conversation with them, where I basically asked, what kind of support and help do you need from Congress to make sure that you're supporting and helping farmers across upstate New York? And so working with them on solutions as well.
And just quickly here, you were here in Sullivan County not too long ago talking about Exit 114, talking about the importance of it. Can you talk quickly about why you support not closing Exit 114 here in Sullivan County?
Yeah, I'm actually doing this interview with you from Monticello. I'm at a meeting with the county legislature today, wanted to talk with them about some issues with the federal budget. going from here to visit some folks at Catholic Charities, and then going out to visit a couple of our rural hospitals, one in Sullivan County, one over in Ulster County. So I love being in Sullivan County. And my last trip here a couple of weeks ago was down in Wurtsboro, exactly this issue. Wurtsboro, tons of really great small businesses, thriving community, really close-knit. And for listeners who aren't familiar with the background here, Route 17 will be transformed into a federal interstate. And when that happens, there's a risk at exit 114. Folks coming westbound get off of to go into Wurtsboro. That could be closed down once it becomes a federal interstate 86. And I went around and talked to all the small businesses in town. I talked to the community leaders and I asked them what impact that would have on them. And they said it would cost them 60, 70, 80% of their business. And that would just devastate the town. And this is something that's personal for me. My hometown got hollowed out and gutted when the businesses left and IBM left town. And I want to see this community succeed. And so I'm doing everything I can to keep exit 114 open to make sure that economic activity continues there. I'm pushing the regulators really hard to keep it open. And in my back pocket, we have federal legislation, if worse comes to worse, that we could potentially try.
Congressman, thank you so much for your time. I do really appreciate it. And enjoy the rest of your day here in Sullivan County.
Yes, absolutely will do. Thank you so much for having me.
Patricia Revere speaking to New York 19th's Congressman, Congressman Josh Riley, who was in the area in Sullivan County yesterday. We'll take a break. And when we come back, hiking the Catskills, it's getting warmer. Well, maybe not today. But as you think about that first hike, what do you bring? We'll find out what you need to know after this. This is Radio Catskill.
What happens when you think no one's looking? Is it dancing alone in an elevator? Find out on the next Selected Shorts. Stories about what happens when there are no prying eyes. I'm Meg Wolitzer.
Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we profile Myra Melford, a multidimensional pianist and composer. From big band to solo, trio to quintet, any setting is fair game for this master improviser.
There are a lot of different strains of music in there, but they're all kind of brought together through my own sensibility of how these things should come together.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me Sunday at 8 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now that spring is officially here, more people might be thinking about that first hike of the season in the Catskills, but what should you bring with you? Longtime hiker and founder of the Catskill 4000 Club, Paul Misko, is addressing this in his talk, Packed for Adventure, Hiking the Catskills Then and Now, at the Time in the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville this Sunday. Radio Catskill contributor Tracy Gates spoke with Paul about his love of hiking in the Catskills and the interesting things people brought with them in the 1800s versus today.
Hi, Paul. This is Tracy from Radio Catskill. Can you hear me all right?
Hi, Tracy. How you doing? I hear you fine.
Okay, terrific. I'm excited to hear about the presentation that you'll be giving on Sunday, March 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Time and Valleys Museum in Grahamsville. It is Packed for Adventure, Hiking the Catskills Then and Now. The title really piqued my interest. What led you to the idea for this talk in particular?
Well, I've been working on putting together a history book of Woodland Valley. And in doing so, I've been getting so many great photos of people in the 1800s and early 1900s hiking, and also hearing their hiking stories.
Mm-hmm. You've been hiking in the mountains for how many years? Your whole lifetime, yes?
Yeah, I think when I was 5, I wandered off into the woods first time.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I was in Boy Scouts, so, you know, I got into hiking and camping, and you learn more and more, and you go through the cycles of equipment and upgrading.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started seeing and hearing about how the people in the olden times hiked and camped, some of it's humorous looking back, but they were pretty rugged individuals back then.
You say rugged, so in what ways?
Well, they didn't have a lot of the comforts we have today for hiking and camping.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was the age of John Burroughs and others used even Civil War surplus goods.
Mm-hmm.
It was the age of canvas and leather and iron, you know,
mm-hmm.
iron pots and pans and hauling heavy equipment up into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your lighting was candles. You know, we didn't have these great LED flashlights and all, and didn't have Gore-Tex and ponchos and a lot of things that we have today that makes outdoors adventures so much easier and safer.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned John Burroughs, and he lived in the Catskills in the 1800s and early 1900s. Is that correct?
Yes, he was born in 1837 in mm-hmm. Roxbury, but really started hiking, I'd say, in the 1860s,
mm-hmm.
and started writing about it. And mm-hmm. his writings, as well as other people like T.M. Longstreet writing about their hiking and camping adventures, got so many more people interested in hiking and camping in the Catskills.
Mm.
In fact, they wanted to often retrace the very trails that these authors wrote about and try to experience the same thing. John wrote about his hiking starting in the 1870s,
mm-hmm.
and people were quickly reading his articles about his hikes and mm-hmm. said, hey, I want to try that, you know?
Yeah.
And he did write, though. He did caution. He said, you know, when you read about my experiences, don't forget there's the downside. There's the times when you get soaking wet from the rain, when the bugs are bad, you know, so be prepared for the negative things as well.
Mm.
But it's a lot of fun overall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He was hiking where exactly? I mean, throughout the Catskills or mostly?
Well, mm-hmm. you know, mainly he actually liked Woodland Valley. Woodland Valley mm-hmm. area was his favorite valley.
Mm-hmm.
And he hiked. He did some in the Neversink area,
mm-hmm.
and his famous essay, Heart of the Southern Catskills, in the Riverbee edition, a volume of his set, talks about in 1884, he and a friend wanted to go up to Slide Mountain because Slide had recently been declared the highest in the Catskills,
mm.
and everyone wanted to go there because it was the highest. There was a big buzz about it even back then,
mm.
and so he and a friend, Ingersoll, attempted to climb to Slide by way of Wittenberg and Cornell and then Slide, and they didn't make it.
Mm.
And he came down into Woodland Valley, fell in love with the valley.
Mm-hmm.
The next year, with three other friends, they went up to Slide Summit by way of Woodland Valley, which is a much rougher hike than the usual trail. What's great about his writings is he describes a lot of details about what they had, what the weather was like,
mm-hmm.
the good and bad experiences,
mm-hmm.
and that's what makes it very interesting, so fascinating to read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What other things are you going to be covering in your presentation? Is this something that you'll also be a little bit of show and tell?
Yeah, I'll bring a few items, really the old, you know, folding candle lantern and some other things that mm-hmm. were common back then. Candles was the main source of lighting.
Mm, wow.
But they had a lot of clever little devices back then that are long forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go through some of the early equipment, the changes in the equipment, everything from clothing. What's interesting from the photos is in most of them, the people are pretty well dressed
mm.
as they're climbing these mountains. Men are in their white shirts and vests and jackets.
Uh-huh.
Women are wearing long dresses and, you know, fancy hats.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they wanted to look proper when they're out. these would be like, you know, the shirts that were a little torn, the coats that were a little tattered.
Uh-huh.
But still, they looked much better than today's hiker in a lot of ways. A little classier.
Yeah, exactly. What about shoes?
Well, they just wore their work shoes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Equipment made specifically for hiking
mm-hmm.
didn't start until early 1900s, and that was mainly for the wealthier people.
Mm-hmm.
But so you just brought whatever gear you had that was kind of worn and stained and tattered, and that became your camping and hiking gear.
Mm, I see.
And, you know, it was functional.
Yeah. You mentioned how heavy everything was. What kind of materials were they using then?
Well, in the earliest campouts, mm-hmm. they didn't really bring tents.
Mm.
They would just sleep out in the open, most commonly.
Mm-hmm.
And when it rained, they got wet. Some of them had rubberized ponchos. They actually had those in the Civil War time, and they could buy those surplus. But most of the time, they were just out there if they could find a ledge to sleep under. That was common. There's photos of people sleeping under little ledges and caves on the mountaintops when they could. Army surplus blankets.
Yeah.
And even in the 1960s, when I was in Scouts, I mean, our first tents were Army surplus from World War II.
Right.
And everything was heavy. You know, I mean, the tents were heavy. So especially more so back then when clothing was heavy. You didn't have a nice form-fitting backpack, you know. So it was rougher, but they seem to really have a lot of fun. They write about it, and you could see the smiles on the faces.
Yeah. Do you bring some of the writing with you? I mean, are you quoting a bit from different people?
Yes, I usually use a few Burroughs quotes and certainly a lot of stories and incidents, funny and funny and tragic, you know, that happened in hikes of of people back then.
Yeah.
And they sometimes, there's photos of them clowning around on the mountaintop. So they seem to be enjoying it, even out in 4 foot snow, snowshoeing up Slide Mountain.
Oh my gosh.
Pretty hardy souls back then.
Yeah. I was struck, actually, that there were plenty of women that did this as well. Do you have some pictures of those intrepid women?
Yes, I have. One of my favorite photos is two women who are hiking. They're almost to the summit of Wittenberg, which is a tough mountain to climb. And they're in their long dresses and their fancy hats,
oh,
and they have their handbags, but they're climbing up this one ledge because you wanted, it was just you felt an obligation to dress nice when you're out in public, even if you're hiking. You know, so that was the way they did it.
Yeah.
And only later in the 1920s, 30s, 40s did hiking clothes start being available for anybody to go buy, men and women alike.
I was curious if there was anything about hiking in the 1800s or the turn of the century that you wish you could experience or that you wish we could return to. Is there anything that you think, oh, I wish that I had been able to experience that?
Well, I wouldn't wish for my tent to be heavier. I think, I mean, now if you go up Giant Ledge, for example, a very popular hiking spot on the weekend, there could be 200 or 300 people on a Saturday. And, you know, that's, the mountains are very busy nowadays. So I do a lot of bushwhacking. I found other spots on mountainsides off the trail. But you have to have experience and the right equipment to just be able to go off and do that.
So
I guess the only thing that would be nicer is back then, you know, you could have the mountain summit to yourself usually.
That makes a lot of sense. I also noticed that you founded the Catskill 4000 Club. Could you tell me like the difference between that and the Catskill 3500 Club?
I had a feeling this would come up. Well, it's, I have to state, first of all, 3500 Club is a fantastic hiking group. It's a very large group. They do a lot of great service projects, and it's a worthy goal. I don't have an interest in climbing the mountains on their list. I like the Woodland Valley area mostly. And I don't have that much time to spend hiking a lot of different mountains I'm not interested in. So to have fun with the idea of peak bagging, in 2009, I started the 4000 Club. It sounds more impressive, and there's only two mountains to climb.
Is it limited to the? I can't imagine it's just limited to those two, is it?
Well, those are only two in the Catskills over 4,000. So it's just a small group of friends. We're not trying to become a big group.
Gotcha.
But we have fun, and and the T-shirts are kind of cool. So, you know, and then I've led hikes with many other groups. There's lots of Catskill Mountain Club and other fantastic groups out there.
Is there a Catskill hike in particular that has maybe the most historical significance for you, one that is your favorite?
I would say probably Slide Mountain has some of the most fun history. There was an early trail that's not the trail today, but it was built in the 1870s by Jim Dutcher. and he became the famous guide of Slide Mountain. And also in 1912, the state put a fire tower, only 15-foot tall fire tower, and they actually rigged a telephone that went all the way down the mountain in case somebody saw a fire. They could make a phone call.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's hard to believe. In 1912, you could call from Slide Summit and order a pizza.
That is well, I don't know if they could do that, but that's amazing.
Might take a while.
Exactly.
But, you know, it was pretty ingenious. In fact, people said you could still see some of the wire along the trail in the woods. But a lot of towers were built on the mountain summits. A lot of times people would just get together and build one.
Mm.
Now it's against the law to do that. But back then, a lot of the summits actually had little towers made out of logs. You could climb up and get an even better view.
Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you out on hikes, or do you kind of wait until it gets a little less muddy?
I'm not so big on the cold anymore. I used to go winter camping and all, but one day when the dinner froze in my bowl, I said, why am I doing this again? So now, like tomorrow and the next day are going to be great, sunny, warm days. So, of course, I'll be out on a hike each day.
Mm.
I go alone. I go with friends. I go with the group, you know, whatever. But I really, it just does so much good to be out in the woods, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Just so relaxing, good exercise.
Yes, yes. Also says that you'll be covering what every hiker who's hiking around the Catskills should carry in their day pack. Can you give us a little sense of what you carry, or maybe just a few things that you think, oh, you should definitely need this?
When I lead a hike, and the people in my group know this, but when I lead a hike for another group, I said, please carry at least a lighter, a good flashlight, you know, rain jacket, and a space blanket of some type.
Mm.
Those little reflective blankets.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people don't. There's a lot of people on the mountains who just have their cell phone and their water bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now and then, if you read the DEC reports, people get lost on the summits. They get hurt on the summits. And you don't want to spend a night overnight on the mountain.
No.
With nothing, no equipment.
Yeah,
it happens so often that people end up staying on the mountain longer than they intended.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you have kids, if you're hiking with kids, a lot of times the parents carry all the emergency gear. Well, if your kid gets lost, wanders off, which kids will do, they should at least have a flashlight and space blanket on them.
Yes, yes.
And show them what it is and how to use it in case they get separated. They've got something instead of nothing.
Yeah.
So in our group, we make sure everyone has, you know, just a few items that are always in their day pack in case something happens.
Yeah. That is such good advice that I'm going to go home and check out my day pack and make sure those things are all in there. People are going to learn a lot more by coming to your talk on Sunday.
Oh, I've got lots of great photos I'll be showing, as well as a few of my artifacts to pass around.
Oh, fantastic. Well, actually, Paul, I think I might meet you there because I'm really interested in this and I want to get out there.
Sure.
I've been talking with Paul Misko. He'll be at the Time and Valleys Museum this Sunday at 2 p.m. Get there a little early so you can get your seat. I believe that it's free for members and $5 if you're not a member. You can also, I believe, hear and listen to this virtually. You can go to timeandvalleysmuseum.org for information about that. But Paul, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I'm excited to come in and hear many more details and see them as well on Sunday.
Sure. Thank you. Hope to see you there. And it's been fun.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. Bye now.
Take care.
This is Radio Chatskill contributor Tracy Gates speaking to hiker Paul Misko. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that this Old House Radio Hour debuts Sunday morning at 7 here on Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River, riverreporter.com, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
On the next This Old House Radio Hour, American Pickers Mike Wolf shares his story of renovating a 100-year-old general store.
I'm a romantic, and I think about when I look out the window when I'm looking at the Mississippi River, that's the same exact view that someone had from 1860.
And we answer all your home improvement questions. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from APM, American Public Media.
Premieres this Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Those windy conditions are continuing this afternoon with wind gusts up to 30 miles an hour, a high of 42, clear low 28 tonight. Tomorrow, cloudy skies with periods of rain later in the day and a high of 48. And for Sunday, sunny and a high of 38. And then overnight, snow accumulating 1 to 3 inches.